open house committee on revenue. This is Tuesday afternoon, the 14th of June. We are getting started about 5 minutes late. Apologize. We are posted for 1 o'clock. We are also posted for 1 o'clock on Thursday.
Good afternoon.
Anything which we do not accomplish today will be moved over to Thursday, and I anticipate there will still be some bills. We have just recently received the amendments on 3481 and 31. My anticipation is that those are two bills that we'll move over with 283. I anticipate that what we will do is go ahead with Senate Bill 996, 896, and Senate Bill 480 today. With regard to 996, this bill requires reconsideration of vote by which it passed from committee, requires six of the nine members to vote in favor of reconsideration, and that's for the purpose of adopting conflict amendments.
Okay.
So what I will do is, let's see, Paul, 996, in order to open a work session on it, I have to have a motion to reconsider first.
Yeah.
You have a
The motion, Representative Berger makes the motion that we reconsider the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 996 for the purpose of amending and adopting conflict amendments. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? So ordered. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 996. Again, this is for reconsideration of the vote for adopting the conflict amendments. Paul, do you have a conflict amendment?
Mr. Chair, 996 A3 amendments are in your packet. And there is a new section there in bold referring to House Bill 2446.
Right.
And that's where the conflict potentially lies. And, of course, this is something you run into more at this time of this session as other bills are passing and there's reference to parts of the statutes that are changing. So this does not in any way change the policy decisions that you made when you first approved Senate Bill 996.
Colleagues, is there any discussion relative to the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 996 to resolve the conflict? Representative Boquist moves the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 996. Discussion of the motion. Is there any objection to moving the A3 conflict amendments to Senate Bill 996? Hearing and seeing no objection, so ordered. Representative Berger?
I move Senate Bill 996 as A3 in gross amended to the floor with due pass.
The motion is to move the A3 amendment to Senate Bill 996 to the floor with due pass. The A3 is dated 6705. Any discussion to the motion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, and recognizing that Representatives Hass and Galizio are excused on other business, the motion passes. Let's see. That was a conflict amendment that should be addressed in the on the floor. So we do need a carrier. Okay. Representative Berger. Representative Berger will carry that. With that, we will.
This chair, just point 996 has not been to the floor yet, so you'll need to through the issues. And
okay.
This is just a modest change.
Representative Berger will carry that to the floor with the conflict amendment with the whole bill.
Okay.
Do pass. Thank you. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 996. We have the amendment on. We'll just jump before you. Okay, you're right here, Paul. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 480. Colleagues, 480, you have a A12 in your packet, and this is after some considerable work by the office, Legislative Revenue Office, Department of Revenue, and we'll just have Paul bring us up to date on the A12 on Senate Bill 480.
Okay. Mr. Chair, these are based on discussions with staff and Chairman Butler, with Legislative Counsel with Dexter Johnson, and these are incorporated in the A12 amendments. These changes were done starting from the A11, as you recall from the last meeting. And I'll go through what the key changes are. The first one is on the first page under Section 2. The Dash 11 had some references to abusive tax shelters, references to listed transactions, and there seemed to be a fair amount of confusion as to what the difference was and what was meant by that terminology. So Section 2 makes it very clear that the bill is referring to a listed transaction, and the listed transaction is defined under 6707A of the Internal Revenue Code. That was also in the original bill that came over from the Senate and in your Dash 11s. But the change is that instead of having the department have any discretionary authority in terms of rulemaking for additional abusive tax shelter transactions, it puts in the language that was in the Dash 7 that you considered in the last discussion. The Dash 7 amendments deleted that discretionary authority on the part of the DOR, but added in language regarding real estate transactions, the REITs and RICs, which are added to the definition. So that comes directly from the Dash 7s, and that language should be the same. It also defines a reportable transaction, but it makes it, at least in my mind, makes it clearer the distinction between a reportable and listed transaction. A listed transaction is what we're referring to in terms of what would be subject to the VCI, the Voluntary Compliance Initiative, later in the bill. The reportable transactions are not subject to a penalty, and therefore they're not subject to the Voluntary Compliance Initiative. You can also see the reportable transaction is more clearly defined on page 2, lines 13, 14, 15, and 16. That a reportable transaction is one that's listed as reportable IRS code or a listed transaction. So a listed transaction must be reported or a reportable transaction according to IRS code. Again, there's no additional discretion on the part of the Department of Revenue.
Now, Paul, it's my understanding that a listed transaction is already reportable under the Internal Revenue Code.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. This makes it reportable to our Department of Revenue as well as the Internal Revenue Service.
Okay. And it would further help because we're defining a little different definition of listed transactions in that process than the Internal Revenue Code does.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We're adding that language from the Dash 7 amendments, the REITs and RICs language, to the IRS definition. The next policy change is under Section 8A, which is on page A6. There was a fair amount of discussion regarding the penalties and the penalty structure and the stacking of penalties. And what 8A does is make some modifications to that. It makes it clear that the penalties described in under Section 7, the accuracy-related penalty, and Section 8, which is the understatement penalty, those are or penalties, that they are not to be added together. So the Department of Revenue would make a decision which penalty is applicable. They would not be added together. And then under 8A sub 2, the total amount of penalties, this is a new cap, but the total amount of penalties under 6, 7, and 8 and existing penalties under existing statute cannot sum to more than 60% of the amount of the underpayment. So there's a 60% cap.
But while penalties stack, they won't stack to a greater percentage than 60%.
That's correct. So yes, there is stacking for multiple infractions, but they cannot sum to more than 60%. The next section is under Section 13. This refers directly to the Voluntary Compliance Initiative. And the Voluntary Compliance Initiative, now it's clearly stated that this applies to tax liabilities that are listed transactions. So again, there's no reportable transactions are not something you would come forward and say, I've got these reportable transactions. So these are the listed transactions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hass.
Paul, could you give us the significance of that?
Representative Hess, I think the significance, or at least the intent here, was the confusion between the two, and particularly the reportable transactions going backward. So what this does is that it applies the VCI to past tax years, and it retains the 1999 beginning year for a six-year look back. But it makes it clear that only applies, the look back portion only applies to the listed transactions. Reportable transactions apply going forward. So that, remember, reportable transactions are really a monitoring effort where you're saying you've got to report these on your returns, but there's no penalty directly involved in those. Just that the department is monitoring them, Internal Revenue Service is monitoring them. So that was an issue the committee talked about, but this language makes it very clear that the reportable transactions are not part of the look back. So those that the other only other change that would be of any significance is that there's language that makes it clear that the six-year look back begins in 1999, but it also becomes a moving target on listed transactions. So the department would have discretion to go back 6 years. So once the voluntary compliance initiative period is over, and the department would have these new penalties, and there's also some additional language to clarify that those penalties would not be applied before the VCI. But once the VCI is over, then the new penalties come into play, and the six-year look back becomes a moving target. So if the department defines something is auditing returns in 2008, it could be applied back to 2002. So the 1999 is not a fixed date. It's only for the VCI and the period immediately following it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hass is recognized.
Paul, the California model that we were looking at, what did it do with respect to reportable and listed transactions looking forward, looking back, and for how long?
The California look back period was for 8 years, and I believe they applied to the listed transactions as defined under the IRS, and also gave the department some additional authority to do that, to define what would be a listed transaction. They also had applied it to REITs and RICs in California. And that's actually where, based on their data, a fairly significant amount of their revenue came from. In the voluntary compliance initiative, almost it was a little less than 50% of their corporate revenue came from REITs and RICs in the California VCI.
Is that responsive, Representative?
Yes. Where is the REITs and RICs
section? That language appears in section 2, and it begins in sub B there. Mm-hmm. Sub B. The sub A part is a listed transaction defined under IRS code, and then the sub B begins the different REITs and RICs definitions and sources.
Representative Comp is recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Butler. Paul, am I remembering right that some states had possibly back to a 10-year look back, but it, from the research that I read, it appeared that well, I guess I'd like to have your impression. Is it important to have more or less, or it just seems like it peaked at a certain time right after it was implemented, and I didn't know whether the amount of years was critical to the overall benefit of the program?
Representative Comp, there's a number of things. First of all, the states that we know that have gone through a voluntary compliance initiative process. California went back 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
Illinois went back through the year 2000.
Okay.
So they were 5 years.
Okay.
There's trade-offs there. We know that the incentives for abusive tax shelter were greatest during the stock market boom of the late 90s. Because, I mean, that's the bubble economy. A lot of income was generated, and the incentive was certainly stronger. We know that these were being marketed and used extensively during that period, particularly in California. However, the other policy issue is that, you know, the further you go back, the more burden you impose on taxpayers. If you're going back 10 years, that imposes more burden on them in terms of record keeping and so forth. So that's kind of the policy trade-off. And this, the Dash 12 shortened the 8-year time or the 10-year time period that was in your Senate version and reduces it to 6.
Thank you.
Let's see, Paul, you were through Section 13.
I think I've gone through the changes, Mr. Chair. We had some other minor things, for example, to ensure that a taxpayer who had a listed transaction and also had other issues that would be available for the general amnesty, that they weren't excluded from those non-listed transaction activities. So some clarifying language of that nature. But I think I've gone through what were the significant changes from the Dash 11s. The Dash 12 amendments do not affect our revenue impact estimates of $28.9 million from the Dash 11s. I see these more as clarifying language.
Further questions of staff? Representative Galizio is recognized.
Paul, there was talk about placing on the internet, is that an element of tax cheaters? I just can't remember where that was.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I've just gotten these amendments. Yes, that was eliminated, Representative Galizio.
That was eliminated?
Yes, that was eliminated.
When?
In these amendments from the Dash 11s.
And
follow up.
Sorry, what was the thinking behind eliminating?
Representative Berger.
If I could respond to that, Representative, I was the one that was a little bothered by the language in there. And in talking to the Department of Revenue, all of the information is public information and listed. My fear is that this wall of shame thing exposes us up to some sort of liabilities if we're wrong. And there is, I believe, an easier way to get that information to anybody who wants to go in and see the tax compliance. So I was more comfortable taking it out, knowing that this is public record information that is easily accessed.
Further questions of staff? I might just say that I did have an opportunity to visit with the director of the department, and there was a concern of the public square flogging and the folks in stocks and the potential liability of folks with similar names and those kinds of things. And I understand that there is some potential listing of everybody that owes the state of Oregon on a similar website in one single location. Okay, further questions? Colleagues, we are in work session with regard to Senate Bill 480. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move a request of a change of the subsequent referral from Joint Ways and Means to House Budget on this bill.
Thank you very much. Representative Berger has noted that this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We need to request a rescission of that to the Joint Ways and Means, which isn't active right now, and to move it to the House Budget Committee. Let's have any discussion relative to that motion. I think that's a housekeeping motion. Is there any objection to that motion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Haas?
I'd like to know why we want to do that as opposed to make some amendments and send it to the floor.
Well, this merely as to why we don't want to have or why we want to have it remain in a budget committee. My understanding is that that this will become part of a discussion relative to how much penalties may be raised relative to balancing the final budget. And that's in Ways and Means where that discussion is ongoing, Representative. And so the discussion is whether you move it to Ways and Means, which isn't an operation, or whether you move it to the budget. But your point is, let's just move it to the House floor and debate it there.
Yes, I mean, given the lateness of the day here, and I think that is, we have had some bills that will affect the bottom line at the end of the session that have gone straight to the floor, some tax credit bills and such. And so I would encourage us to move it straight to the floor.
I would respond that we will still have an opportunity to vote on this, so far as I know. This bill will come out of Ways and Means and will give us an opportunity at some point to vote on it on the floor. It's my understanding that there are parties that are not happy with the adjustments which we are making, and they would like to have yet one more shot at it in the Ways and Means process, and this does have a subsequent right now to the joint Ways and Means as it came out of, as it was previously signed, it came out of the Speaker's office.
My fear is that the clock will run out on this bill.
I don't think it will. I think that this is a very key piece of legislation and balancing the budget, Representative. And the question is whether or not it raises X number of dollars or X number in addition to that. And I don't see it raising any less than what we've anticipated. But the possibility of modification of the date certainly could, if the date went to 7 years from 6 years, that could potentially raise several millions of dollars more. So. And that may be in play at that point. Representative Boquist?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just a question for Paul. There is like a $9.2 million fiscal on this, right?
Right.
Which comes out of the collection, right? Is that correct? Yes.
No, Representative Boquist, the estimated fiscal impact from the elements of the VCI and the amnesty, you know, deleting some of the other elements that were in the original 480, I believe is about $500,000. Looking at $600,000.
Yeah, six and change is where we've gotten it down to by eliminating the website, which was a very expensive, very spending piece of that.
So the other thing, Representative Boquist, we have worked to coordinate with the DOR budget so that this is in addition to it.
Okay. Further discussion. The motion is to move this and request a change from the subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means over to the House Budget Committee. Is there any objection to the motion? Okay. Let's call a roll on that motion.
Representative Boquist.
Yes.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Felicio?
No.
Representative Kong?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
No.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hess?
No.
And Chair Butler?
Butler votes yes. The motion having received the required number of votes, we'll move that then by request. We'll request your moving of the bill, the subsequent referral, over to the House Budget Committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I'd like to move the 8-12 amendments to Senate Bill 480.
The motion is to move the A-12 amendment to House Bill 480, dated 6-14. Discussion.
We've worked pretty hard on this, and I appreciate all the folks who've come together on this. Specifically to Representative Galizio, I did forget to mention that one of my objections to the Wall of Shame website was the cost that it would take in the Revenue Department to maintain such a thing, which made it even easier to say let's not spend more to get more. This is very difficult stuff. I, in my own way, feel good that it does get a subsequent referral and another set of books down in budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gulley.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and I think there has been a lot of work. And And although there is a cost, I think, you know, the prospect of having really negative publicity is a very strong one. And I think it is, if you look in other states, Georgia, Connecticut, Maryland, it has sort of paid for and then gone far beyond. So I think it would have been a wise investment. I think we should have kept that element to it. And I think in the end, it's just for businesses and individuals that are honest and paying their taxes, folks that are cheating just put a greater burden on corporations and small businesses that are paying their fair share. So,
thank you. Further discussion to the motion? Again, the motion is to append the A-12 amendment to Senate Bill 480, dated 6-14-05. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Boakley.
Yes.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Felicio.
No.
Representative Tom.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
No.
Vice Chair Burton.
Aye.
Vice Chair
House?
No.
Chair Butler?
Butler votes aye. The motion to append the A-12 amendment to Senate Bill 480 is adopted, having received sufficient votes. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 480 to the committee, the House Budget Committee, with the due pass recommendation.
The motion is to move 480 as amended with the A-12 to the House Budget Committee. Discussion on that motion? The clerk will call the roll. The motion is to move Senate Bill 480 with the A-12 amendments dated 6-14-05 to the House Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boakley.
Yes.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Felicio.
No.
Representative Kahn.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hess?
No.
And Chair Butler?
Butler votes aye. The motion, having received the constitutional majority, is passed, and Senate Bill 480, as amended today, will move to the House Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Colleagues, with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 480. That's 896 is Elizabeth. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 896. Colleagues, we have the set of amendments on 896. I think there's two amendments, A4 and A5. Ms. Beth?
Chairman Butler and committee members, with Senate Bill 896, you have a dash A4 and a dash A5. And basically, this was the one for the water vessel manufacturers in Oregon. So, again, what this bill does with the dash A4 is it establishes a new employer tax credit for wages paid to employees who assist in that manufacture of a water transit vessel, and then it defines what a water transit vessel is, and then it's specifying now that the tax credit will be the lesser of $5,000 or 15% of the wages paid to employees during the tax year. It's $5,000 per employer. Originally in the A and gross it was $2,500, so that's what this portion of it did is that doubled that. Then it basically clarifies that the wages have to be included in the tax credit calculation cannot include wages from employees that the employer receives federal funds for on-the-job training. It also allows both a deduction and a credit for that employer for those wages. Now, it also specifies that there'll be a sunset in the tax credit on January 1st, 2013. So basically, that's all the dash A4 does. It's just make some changes as far as doubling that tax credit amount, and then it goes and places a sunset of January 1st, 2013 on the tax credit, which the Engross did not have. So also, it's a seven-year sunset.
Yeah, I'll also need to mention that there was some concern in the original language that the watercraft needed to be a actual transit vehicle for the purpose of carrying passengers for 50 or more passengers, and the A4 amendment of 6605 actually does that as opposed to just water vehicles, water transit vehicles. These would actually be water transit vehicles that would be certified, licensed, and inspected for the primary purpose of designed to carry 50 or more passengers. I think that was right. There was some concern that this could just be for barges, and we just didn't want to have. If this is a new industry, a returning industry to Oregon, the incentive was to try and bring them back under a specialized program.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that, again, this doesn't have a significant revenue impact because it is got a small cap there, and the cap is per employer, and we're not assuming that many employers are going to be hiring new people and then getting the tax credit. So it'll be less than $50,000 per year.
Further discussion on the A4 amendment. Representative Berger?
Now, what happened to Elizabeth, what happened to the $1 million? Yep. That's in the A5?
That's A5s.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. So are you ready to A5s?
Well, let's see. Is there further question on the A4? We're in work session. Representative Riley? Representative Riley moves the A4 amendment dated 6605. Is there any discussion to the motion? Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, I recognize Representative Esquivel has been excused momentarily. We will append the A4 by order. So moved. So ordered. And A5.
Okay, so with the A5, it includes everything that is in the A4, except that it also provides that property tax exemption. So now this is slightly changed from the first time we heard this, but basically what it's doing is providing a specially assessed property value for 7 years for companies manufacturing these water vessels. So you'll see that basically also on lines 19 through 21, it clearly says there the property can be newly constructed real property improvements, newly acquired and installed real property machinery and equipment, or newly acquired taxable personal property. So it really is trying to get at anything that is new to the manufacturer. Then it also establishes an application process with Economic and Community Development Department for the company who wishes to claim then this property tax special assessment. So initially the company will has to invest more than $1 million in new or newly acquired real or personal property equipment. Annually also the company must pay then property taxes on that first $1 million. So that's clarified. Basically you pay your property taxes on that first $1 million, then anything above that is what is then is exempt for 7 years. So basically it's kind of like freezing the property taxes for this manufacturer for 7 years. So regardless of how many new improvements they make, those would be off the tax roll. Then it places a sunset on the property tax special assessment of 7 years. So you also have a 7-year sunset on the property tax component as well as the income tax component.
So, Elizabeth, this requires new investment, both
right.
Personal and real property.
That's right.
And it must be more than $1 million.
That's right.
But the portion that would qualify for the exemption is all new property
right.
Above the $1 million.
That's right.
Including if they manufacture on-site machinery mm-hmm. equipment, if they manufacture new construction buildings.
Chairman Butler, it's pretty much taking a particular, a company and saying we're going to freeze your property taxes at $1 million if you have more than if you can prove you have more than $1 million in real property or personal property. And then for 7 years, you have to show that you have still more than $1 million with the depreciation of your assets. But still, if you can show at least that you have more than $1 million, then everything else will be off
So this is newly constructed real property improvements and newly acquired or installed real property machinery and equipment. So so if and I think the example was the other day that there are certain families that may already own this property that would renovate or return this property to the tax rolls because it's presently it's on the tax rolls with an unused basis on the tax rolls.
That's right.
Would return it to the but in order to get any exemption, first of all, they have to have new constructed improvements
That's
to
right.
it and additions of personal property, but then the exemption is only to the extent that it's over $1 million.
That's right. So the first $1 million would be taxable.
Okay. And so the ground and the existing buildings, if they were worth $50 million, they would stay on at $50 million. If they added $10 million of new construction, then only $1 million of that would come on the rolls.
That's right.
Okay, Representative Riley.
Okay. Yeah, I think you just asked the question I wanted to ask. But let me. Any even newly acquired property and buildings that are already existing buildings are not exempted, and are not part of the first. The million that we're talking about.
Representative Riley, that's correct. If you see, like in line 22, there it says all property described in paragraph A. So that's meaning the newly acquired, constructed, all of that has to exceed $1 million in real market value.
Okay. Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm struggling a little bit with this bill altogether. I mean, trying to pull it all together. Not that we've had a few bills that I've struggled with this last 23 weeks, but
has it been that long?
Yeah, I'm counting. I guess I'm thinking here. I realize that this is a bill that's targeting, basically, it appears, anyways, from my view, the waterways up there in the metro area, because that's going to be the largest area for this kind of stuff. But I'm thinking, why is that not maybe done on a local basis rather than us, I mean, statewide getting involved with this. That's where I guess I might
as an enterprise zone of some kind.
I don't know. I'm just wondering.
That's a valid question. That's a valid question. Representative Berger?
Yeah, I have similar concerns about this very. I think that there is potential in this arena of adding boat building to our transportation manufacturing infrastructure, which we all know is very good in Oregon. I'm not sure that this $1 million piece, the original bill, I'm pretty, that's fine. If it's an encourager, that's fine. I'm just not ready to go to the local governments and say, and you're going to spend $1 million, forego $1 million on a hope and a prayer. I will tell you that it's my belief that if any large shipbuilder were to call up OECDD or PDC, Portland Development Commission, or any of the players in Oregon and say, we're about to drop, you know, $20 million to $100 million in shipbuilding in Oregon, they would get plenty of attention, and there are lots of incentives that could be brought to bear.
One of the two
I think. Sounds like we've traded this motorhome.
Yeah, and that's sort of how I feel about this larger piece in the A5s.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, I talked to Senator Starr on this, and I also have some concerns about it. In fact, I talked to him about the two sunset clauses on the two tax structure. But I guess the other thing I have to look at, and of course I'm an advocate for local control, and this is not local control in my opinion. The other thing that, but I will support it because of the sunset. But I look at it like this. We don't have the tax for the $1 million in the first place. Let's leave it at that. What do we have now? Zero. We may have 100% of it, but we still have zero.
And that we probably do have some land and buildings, obviously, that are presently in unused state. It's my understanding that when you go and sweep them up and get the utilities running again and get something going in there, that so far as the assessed valuation on the books, that's going to probably double the assessed valuation, which will immediately increase the local taxes. So that portion of it, that portion, there's none of that that's exempt, is my understanding, under this bill. That would be a great benefit to local governments. And if you did say, fine, we're going to put $50 or $100 million, only the first $1 million is taxed, then what you've got is somewhere between $49 and $99 million if incomes is deferred at that point, and it's deferred for up to 7 years based upon this. But again, the underlying property, by moving it back to a full usage on the tax rolls, is a very, very significant return to the tax rolls. Representative Riley?
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to Representative Olson and tell him that, you know, the people in the south end of the valley just don't understand the culture up in the north part of the valley.
But we don't claim to either.
Representative Boquist?
For a while we were talking about cultural diversity. I have a question, Elizabeth. Could you go over the bottom half of the revenue impact statement so I can... Because I see a negative, which really means a positive, I think. Only in revenue. Revenue impact on the AFOL.
Okay, so yeah, with basically, as we were just talking, the thing with the property tax component is that you don't have to make the investments in new employees and things that you have to make here in the income tax component. So, but in the property tax component, you could just be making new investments in your plant and equipment that you would have to in order to keep, running. And from what I've seen, I mean, it depends on how you narrow, I know we've kind of narrowly defined this to certain types of water transit vessels. But and looking at that kind of subset, there's about 11 employers already here in Oregon that are in this, kind of boat building transit vessel that potentially could qualify. And if you look at some of the investments that are made in those type of companies, it's about $500,000 a year as far as investment. So that's really what this is getting at, assuming that we get like one new boat water transit vessel employer each year, and then you assume that they invest like $2 million in order to get their plant going, and then we have these others that basically could be potentially getting roughly $500,000 each year. And one other point I'll point out with this amendment is that, and I don't know if it was really, this is real clear yet, but this is the way it's written on line 22. It does say cumulatively exceeds $1 million in real market value as of the assessment date. So you don't really know what a cumulative means there, if it means, over the past 2 years or 5 years or, so there could be some, where they've made investments over a certain number of years, then it exceeds $1 million in new investments, and then they're able to claim it. So.
Follow-up, Representative Boquist.
Okay, I'm reading the last three lines of the revenue impact statement. And I got the first one. Act creates personal property assessment investments above $1 million, so the first $1 million is taxable. Mm-hmm. Okay. Property tax exemption will reduce local revenues by less than $50,000 in 2005-2007.
Yeah.
And then it says in 2007-2009 it will increase taxes $348,750. Is that right? That's not a negative. Am I reading this right?
Well, mine has a negative.
It has negative.
Does it have a negative?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Negative
$348,750.
So it's a negative $50,000 and a negative $348,000.
Yeah. And the reason why it's not much initially is just because I was assuming, again, that those companies make on annual average about $500,000. Mm-hmm. Each year, and so you would take a couple years of cumulatively making new investments, and then they'd be able to apply in order to be above the $1 million in new investments.
Oh, sure.
Yes, follow up, please.
Okay, so right now we have zero. and if the world's perfect and we get all kinds of people, then we lose $348,750 in 07-09. What do we gain? We're at zero now, so how much taxes did we gain to get to the negative? Because the first million is tax money. Right, so we have a gain, right? We're at zero now, so we're gaining something.
It depends on the taxing district.
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't it depend on the taxing district?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, and this is, again, it's the kind of philosophy is, you know, would there be an investment? Would there be any new improvements without this tax credit, without this property tax special assessment? And the issue is when we write these, or at least the way this one is it's not dynamic. We haven't, you know, taken this and really extrapolated what are the benefits of having this tax cut. How much additional investment are you going to be getting from having this property tax special assessment?
I guess I'm following the chair.
Representative.
Right here. Okay, we used a formula, and you and I have done a lot of taxes. You got formulas, and you came up, used the formula to say, we got zero now, but we're going to lose $348,000 because we're going to do this. How much, using the same formula for the $1 million that we're still going to tax, are we going to get out of this thing?
Okay. Well, first of all, I would say that we aren't assuming they've got zero now. We're assuming that there are 11 companies in the state, and they're already making some investments each year in order to keep running.
Let me ask about the 11 companies. How many are manufacturing 50 or more watercraft or 50 or more passenger watercraft?
Yeah, and Chairman Butler, that is not something I can get from the employment data. I mean, it's just employment data I have to go on, and so I have to.
So far as transit vessels, there's none of them that are manufacturing these.
Chairman Butler, I'd have to look at it harder far as what is, each one of those.
Representative Berger?
Elizabeth, I think what we're trying to get at here is you have $1 million of property taxes that you've foregone or that you're going to get before you forego any, correct?
Right.
So what's the value of that $1 million worth of property taxes? That's the question, and would it depend on the taxing district and the rate?
Yeah, I mean, it's roughly $15. I mean, that's what we usually assume.
And have you calculated that $15 coming in here?
Right. I mean, you've done this math. Right. You've already assumed, okay, we're going to be paying the first $1 million. What's above that $1 million? This is what then becomes the amount that you're foregoing here because you're giving the special assessment.
Is that representing focus?
No, I'm still trying to figure out. There are no companies making boat passenger 50 or more in the state. I mean, I think that's the good point.
I think that was the
question
testimony the other day.
Is that, how much are we going to gain? I guess the guesstimate. What would be the average investment of each one of these companies? You said $2 million, right?
Right.
So we got $1 million.
So it's $1 million above.
It's 15 per thousand, right?
I'm sorry?
$15 per thousand? Okay, so.
It was. My understanding is that the numbers here are net of. The numbers she's given here are net of property taxes in and then out. Am
right.
I correct?
Right. So you've got $1 million times the $15, actually almost $16, $15.90 per $1,000 assessed value. So then that is the amount that you assume is already coming in under this bill. Now, again, if that $2 million and that company already came, regardless of what you did here today, you would not, local governments wouldn't get this freeze of $1 million capped on their market value for that company. So that's what you're calculating here, is that incremental difference there of what you see them getting if you don't pass this bill. Now, to just clarify, I think roughly if you just assume new companies, one each year, you've got about 15,000. So again, it's less than 50,000 in 07-07 biennium, and 07-09 would be about 116,000 as far as revenue loss instead of the 348. So.
But this is only as the property tax. There's no estimation of any benefit so far as the existing property that would be used, the land, a portion that returns to the rolls at full value.
Yeah, but Chairman Butler, they, you know, this land is being used. Somebody's paying that property taxes, and whether it's being used or not. I mean, you know, so even though it may not be used for that.
That full assessed value.
Yeah, you know, what the land is being used for, you know, is it's all just assessed, you know, and so you don't just take land off the roll because it's not being used.
It's not your experience that an unused building is taxed any differently than the used building. Building in process.
Well, the building and how much production is made in that building is just that. I mean, that's your income tax portion of it, and how much they're going to be able to generate for the state. But as far as the property value is based on, you know, the years, how old the building is, and you know, and now obviously new equipment brings in, you know, additional.
That's not my understanding of local government. That the value of an empty building goes on to rolls at a reduced value until such time as it's returned to the rolls for actually being used. And that's been my experience. Sometimes it's an increase of as much as 50%. And that was what I heard the other day. Was we've got a batch of buildings that are not being used right now, and that just broom sweeping them up and hanging everything back up and getting things back up will bring them back on the roll, the assessment rolls, at their full value, not at their vacant value. And again, my experience is that's a very significant return to the roll, that in and of itself.
Well, Chairman Butler, I mean, I'm sure you could have an assessor or someone come explain, you know, exactly if they have certain values they put on vacant, you know, buildings.
Yeah. Again, that's my prior experience in local government was in the taxation of real property. That's how I started, and I watched it happen time after time for about 12 years. As we would move property back on the rolls, people would say, or we would move it off the rolls because they would say, hey, I can't use it. It's not, for whatever reason, the building is vacant. We would move it off of the roll onto a vacancy roll, which would be a significantly less value of what it had been valued at. And then once it was got cleaned out and dusted up and back on the rolls for any business purpose, then it would return to the rolls with a significantly greater value. And again, that's just my experience from Mountaineer County. I don't know whether that's not practiced in Multnomah County. I thought it was practiced in all counties with M's that began with M's. So. Right. Yes, Representative Burton.
Mr. Chair, one other point about that. In the 2 years down the next biennium, that 248,000 or 348,000, whatever she's estimated, doesn't seem like a lot of money to us dealing with a $12 billion general fund. But there's nothing that presupposes this could land in Portland. It's statewide, and a small community might be hit with, you know, a few more jobs and a heck of a lot less property tax. Should it happen in a small community, and they didn't, we're dealing with a statewide issue here, and they aren't sort of in the mix here. So I'm just really uncomfortable with this kind of a property tax issue at this time. This bill,
okay.
A5s.
Further discussion on the A5s. No further discussion. The chair is open to a motion if we're going to pass this bill, either that or we'll just go ahead and retire this bill with the A5 or with the A4 having been adopted as a portion of it. And I don't see Senator Starr here to stand up for the A5, which would have provided some local property tax exemption. So the A4, it's my understanding, which is the value the credit can be ascribed to new jobs is presently adopted, and that could stand alone without any property tax abatement. And it's just hoped that what happens is that if somebody decides to do this, that they better go to the cities that are involved and make sure that they get included in their enterprise zones or seek one of the new enterprise zones that might be available. Representative Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 896 with the A4 as adopted to the floor with a due pass.
The motion is to move 896A as adopted with the A4 amendment today to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion of the motion? Is there objection to that motion? Hearing and seeing no objection, recognizing that all members are present, the motion is to move Senate Bill 896 with the A4 amendment as adopted today to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Hearing and seeing no objection, so ordered. Representative Boquist, will you carry that?
Delighted.
Okay.
Got a lot of folks.
With that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 896. And Dexter, which bill are you? Did you get some? Oh, okay. No additional amendments for one of these then. Paul, I still showed that on my calendar that we were still waiting for approval on other amendments that are still outstanding. So they're here now? Oh, wonderful. Let's go ahead and 3481 is Lizbeth. And you've had a chance to look at those, Lizbeth. Wonderful.
Yeah. Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 34.
Let's open a work session on House Bill 3481.
And you've got the A6 amendment there. And basically, with this A6 amendment, you've got the changes. I'll just kind of highlight the changes that we talked about and are included, and then eventually you'll probably need feedback from people who are advocates for these changes and make sure it meets their needs. But on page 2, it clearly states there it's that the new property for the property tax exemption is newly constructed, installed, or acquired property, including property that was previously owned by a different owner and used at a different location. So basically it's trying to get at some of the concerns about, clarifying exactly that this can be newly constructed but also acquired property, and it can include property that was owned by someone else, and that it was first put into service during the calendar year in which this exemption then begins. So that's lines 10 through 14 is new language. And then if you move to page 7, that's beginning to clarify more farm storage facilities. And so here on line 1 there, line 1 through 11 there, it says farm storage facility is used exclusively for storing crops used to produce biofuel, and that was not used for any other purpose prior to the date on which the application for certification is filed. So that kind of gets at our onion storage facility originally, and then it's converted
moving
to
moving property back
yeah.
and forth.
Yeah, so that tries to address that. And then the next one just tries to clarify that you also could have a biomass conversion plant that uses, and then it lists all the different things it could use. And then E and F just also illustrate that the equipment is also part of this exemption here. And in this part, we're talking about the pollution control tax credit. So we've got the equipment used in the biofuel processing or biofuel production, and then the equipment used in growing crops that are harvested.
So that would include any specialized harvesting equipment for these crops.
Okay. So that's basically that portion. And then if you go a little further there, page 9 is on lines 18 through 20, it says the biofuel production facility is the same as the A in gross, but also it says, and the facility's purpose conforms to the requirements of ORS 468.155 1A and 3. So that's referring back then here to this section on page 6 and 7. That's that 3A. So that really hopefully addresses some of DEQ's concerns about still making sure that these facilities have to adhere to DEQ's requirements in the pollution control tax credit statutes. Okay. Then we move on to page 15, and there we say basically, again, the facility is a facility described in 468.155.3, and again, that is in your right back there on page 6 and 7 is where you've got that section that you're amending there. That's 468.155 subsection 3. And then on page 17 there, you have the new definition for ag producer, and this just gets at what Representative Krupp was testifying to as far as wanting a farmer to be able to take this biofuels raw material tax credit if they've produced and then also produce the crop, but then also produce the biodiesel or ethanol and use it themselves. So it means a person engaged in farming or livestock operations that produce the plant or animal matter that is used by a biodiesel or ethanol producer to produce the biodiesel, or a person engaged in farming that produces the green biomass used to produce electric energy and so forth. So hopefully that will address that issue there. And then if you look to the next page, page 18, this has the real specific language that people wanted, and it decreases that tax credit amount for the producers from $20 per ton to $10 per green ton. And then it clearly says that the forest or range land vegetative biomass that is delivered to a producer to produce or is used to produce electric energy and so forth. So those are lines 3 through 6 there, is that change then in that tax credit amount, as well as clarifying the biomass.
Question on the tax credit.
Yes, Representative Hess.
You're not at the R&D yet, but you said something to me. Can you, are these mutually exclusive of other R&D?
Yeah, and we'll get there, and there is a section in here where he does specify there that's an addition in the R&D section. Okay, so did you have any question on this one? Okay, so this section here, page 18, 17, and 18 is the biofuel raw material tax credit for farmers, basically. And then when you look on page 19. Lines 15 and 16, this is where that transfer of the tax credit is deleted. So that's the deletion of that portion. And also it deletes Department of Revenue's requirement that they were going to have to administer that. Okay, then if you look on page 25, then there, Representative Hass, this is then dealing with the R&D tax credit. The R&D biofuels and emissions research and development tax credit begins on page 23. And then on page 25 here, lines 11 through 13, it states a taxpayer may not be allowed a credit under ORS 317.152 or 317.154 for the same research and development costs that serve as a basis for this credit. So that's pretty clear. And I think that's it for the major changes there. One other point I wanted to make sure everybody was clear on, because I don't know that I explained it well the last time with we were discussing the bill. With 3481, with this property tax exemption, basically, and it is just 50% of the assessed value of the property, too. It's not a complete exemption. But what it has in here is it clearly is designed to be used if the facility and the new property is being put in a location that is in the same place as an enterprise zone already exists, then this property tax exemption would be allowed after an enterprise zone exemption was already completed. So this would allow an additional 5 years in addition to your 5 years you would already get under the enterprise zone statute. So I just wanted to clarify that, like on page 2, that's why we're changing, like on line 13, a 4 to a 5 and things, so that it was clear in the statute also for the ethanol producers, because this is, again, we already are allowing this property tax partial exemption for ethanol production facilities. And this is going to clearly make it, not ambiguous in the law as far as whether or not the ethanol producer would get a full 5 years in the enterprise zone statutes property tax exemption, and then they could still, for that same facility that they erected in the beginning of their enterprise zone 5 years, they could apply then to get this additional tax credit for the ethanol production facility. So basically there we get a 10-year exemption, with the second 5 years only being 50% of the assessed value. And plus they would have to, once they apply the second time for this specific biofuel or production facilities property tax exemption, they would have to get the local government's consent. So that's the real difference from the enterprise zone statutes, is there's not all this opt-out language that you have here in Section 2 and stuff in specific of this property tax exemption.
Let's see. We also talked about, I'm just going through my list of the concerns that were raised, the 100 horsepower or greater chippers.
Okay. Yeah, Chairman Butler, Representative Council has, or Legislative Council has said that, you know, due to the relating clause in this bill, and if you'll look on the first page here, line 2, it says relating to the expansion of environmental improvements. If we remove chippers from the pollution control tax credit, you would not be expanding environmental improvements. So it can't fit within this relating clause. That's why we didn't get that amendment.
Okay. We tried.
We tried.
Let's see, I think Representative Riley's chipper now qualifies again. Representative Berger?
Yeah, Elizabeth, I have in my notes that there was the definition of biomass being an issue, and where is that?
Good question.
We had cellulosic biomass means, and there was a bizarre list of things. And
okay, yeah, I think it's here.
I want to be sure I know what
it's,
a biomass
it's there.
Is.
It's there. I saw it.
I smell it.
Oh, here it is, yeah. Okay.
Because I have a feeling I will.
Okay, let's see. Page 34 is one definition there. And so it says means forest or rangeland residue or any crop grown specifically for the purpose, of producing. Yeah, that's it. Lines 8 through 11. Or any, and they wanted, or any byproduct of agricultural commodity production. So that looks like what we asked for. And then you've got it again in another section. Put it back here. Page 38. So that's.
Okay, there's some. Okay, and I'm going to...
You can't pass the smell test.
Well, I'm going to... Next one, I'll recognize that this is a biomass.
Chairman Butler, do you want me to talk briefly about the revenue impact?
I think I updated it. Let's see, Representative Hatt's question?
Well, I think I go ahead and go through it first.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Has it changed?
Yeah, well, completed.
Oh, it's completed, which I forgot myself. I'm going to have to get a copy. Okay, so I think the part that we hadn't discussed yet, we're just adding biofuel production and processing facilities and then the others to the pollution control tax credit. So initially, it begins in 2006, but I assume that a lot of that wasn't going to be able to be added on initially, just because these facilities take a while to develop. And we only had one person come testify even to ethanol production as far as many facilities coming on. So basically, so with that portion of it, I just assumed a small group of basically one coming on in 06, but not until the second half of it. And then... I also looked at farm storage, and currently There's some farm storage facilities that DEQ already approves if they're used for storing of straw. So then I used an average that I had gotten from DEQ on that, and then assumed that basically we'd have about 4 per year of these farm storage facilities that could qualify then. And then with the ethanol production, those are the ones that are a little, they're certainly bigger as far as value. I assumed we'd have a couple bigger ones, like 15 million in 2007, and then out in the outer years, 2009 and 10 and 11, just having one of those facilities. And then in 2008, I assumed just a smaller ethanol facility. So basically, the ethanol production was the one that was going to be the bigger of the three different new components that'd be coming on the rolls. And so that's why initially you're not seeing much as far as just a reduction of 100,000, and then in 07, 09 biennium, 1.6 million, and then 3.7 million out in 2009, 11. And as far as the biofuel processing, I assumed roughly about 2.5 million in new investments. And what I took that from was, I saw some different articles on just the different equipment being roughly about a million for to process biomass and stuff. And so that's kind of what I, some smaller versions, and then I assumed about a half a million for other smaller ones that maybe would come on. So I only assumed over the 6 years about 5 per year as far as new, equipment that'd be coming on. This is all something that is pretty difficult to get your hands around, just because it could be various sizes depending on who gets interested in wanting to start this type of production. But it seems like it would be kind of targeted towards more smaller capacities here in Oregon, and there's some going on already, like in Tillamook County and things. I saw some articles on that, and I'm sure the Department of Energy could give a little more background on that if you're interested. Those were pretty small compared to the ethanol was kind of the larger portion of that tax credit. And then the other one that was new that I added there was the biofuels raw material producer tax credit. So that one, basically I looked at some of the Oregon share of the total U.S. production, as well as our own estimates of how much we're producing from some different articles. So basically I looked at biodiesel, ethanol, and then biomass and forced biomass as far as how much we potentially could be producing. And then I assumed a real small portion that we would actually be using of that tax credit. Only about 15-20% would actually be coming online, each year, and that would grow. And then with this being targeted towards farmers, then I didn't assume that they had much tax credit to be able to use these tax credits, and especially with them not being transferred now. So I only assumed about 15-20% also of that amount actually being used by the farmers. So that's how you get the reduction of 47,000 initially. Again, that's only 1 year for 05-07, and then by 07-09, 1.8 million, and then 09-11 biennium, 3.1 million. So the total revenue impact, when you look at just the general fund there, you've got about 1.4 million in 05-07 biennium, 10 million in 07-09. And again, most of that, large portion of that, is really the expansion of the pollution control tax credit. And then as you go out to 09-11, that pollution control tax credit portion just becomes larger. And so that's where you get 10 million there. And so you've got a total there of general fund of about 45 million. And then, as we talked about before, you've got the highway fund revenues that are the gas tax exemption for using biofuel, and then you've got the property tax component. And in the property tax component, it's just the new facilities that I'm including there. It's not kind of clarifying current law either, which is also a component of this as far as you know, whether or not an ethanol producer would get the full 5 years of an enterprise zone exemption or not. So I just didn't include that, but that is a component of the local revenue portion.
Representative Hass. Representative Hass, question? Yes, thanks. This revenue impact statement is all of the new legislation, obviously. But if you were to put the cost of the current tax credit under there, there would be some numbers up there, say, in the top square there under 05, 07, and 07, 09. Wouldn't there be about, in some ways, you would be misled into thinking that the cost of this is 1.4 and 05, 07, when in effect you've still got the same pollution.
Of the total credits?
Yeah, and you didn't put those in the top, so.
Correct. No, I did not put the total amount that we're using a pollution control tax credit.
And that's up to about $28 million?
Yeah, and that is the amount that is certified each year,
right.
Okay? So the amount that actually gets used is, you know, down around, I think, $13 million or so.
So, Mr. Chair, I think it's important just to point out these numbers here, the $44 million and $9.11, are numbers on top of what we would have existing.
Well, that does expand and increases the sunset at that point. So the sunset, if it were to go away, then that would be all of it, wouldn't it?
Well, you'd have to, but you still have 10 years, even if it sunsets and at the end of this year.
Right. Yeah, it's going to take a while for that sunset to come into play, and I don't think we probably hit at all even in 09-11.
So if there's $12 to $13 million per year being used, that's $24 to $26 million per biennium.
Right.
Why are we going to have more used in 09-11?
Well, Chairman Butler, if you see what I have to do is look at how much growth we've seen, and we've seen some growth already in certified amounts, and that's what becomes the basis then under current law of what would be that amount that would go off the tax roll. So that's what I use it.
So there's both an expansion.
There's an expansion. Yeah.
Okay. Further discussion of the amendments. Now, colleagues, it's my understanding that this addresses many of the questions which we had the other day that the proponents of House Bill 3481 would like to see it go through the process of having an opportunity to be heard on the House floor and then moved over to the Senate, where I understand it'll probably go and stuff anyway. So. We'll see what happens. I've been told that.
So
are you encouraging us to vote for this or against it?
We're not sure. I guess you can vote how you will. It does resolve the questions that I think we brought up that were brought up in our previous meeting relative to the concerns of having a fairly significant amount of green biomass credits, as well as having the department administer credits that could be sold to other department or to other taxpayers and so forth. So I think this substantially meets the requirements of items that we were looking at the other day. Is it perfect? I don't know that it's perfect, but it certainly is an improvement from where we first heard it in my way of thinking. So we have before us the A6 amendments. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm willing to move the A6 amendments to House Bill 3481.
Representative Berger is moving the A6 amendments dated 6-14-05 to House Bill 3481. Question or discussion? Representative Collins.
Just for the record, that it's obvious to me that my rubber boots and shovel from 1965 can't be a credit here, so I might as well throw them out.
You're waiting to use them on a credit return.
Well, obviously, you know, so anyway, I totally understand and support this amendment.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Further discussion relative to the motion. The motion, again, is to move the A6 amendment. Is there objection to the A6 amendment? Hearing and seeing no objection, recognizing all members present, the A6 amendment, the motion is passed. Representative Berger?
Yeah, I move House Bill 3481, and I think it is to the House floor.
Yes.
With a due pass recommendation.
The motion is to pass House Bill 3481 with the A6 amendments of 614 appended today to the House floor with a due pass motion. Discussion to the motion. Representatives Hass and then Galizio.
Thank you. I do get a little excited on this issue, and I just briefly I'll just tell you one of the reasons is when I came down here in 2001, this issue came up to extend the pollution control tax credit, and then Governor John Kitzhaber was going to let it go and would veto the bill. He promised to extend it. And some of us were in a work group, and we worked out a compromise in which he agreed to let this bill phase out instead of letting it die abruptly. And within that bill, it raised the standards for what needed to be done. And so I was happy to vote for that compromise. I think it was a good place to find some common ground. And that's why I was so distressed in the following session, 2003, when the proponents, now that John Kitzhaber was gone, wanted to take it back and expand it just like the old days. And that bill passed here and died in the Senate. And I'm distressed again. We're going back on what I thought was a solid compromise. And to continue a tax incentive that is no longer an incentive for 70% of the people who claim this credit, to me it seems like the wrong way to go when we could use this expenditure for some real incentives, for example, biofuels or technology. Even the department has said that this is a reward for people who are obeying the law. And I hate to see the people who want to expand and extend this hijacking a very legitimate issue of biofuels incentives along with this bill. I wish we could find a compromise in this chamber that we could go over there to the Senate, Democrats and Republicans, and lobby them to adopt our compromise, because we've seen on a couple of high-profile issues here, from state tax cuts to bears and cougars, that when the House goes over the top, it lands in a thud over there in the Senate, and there's no action taken. I fear that's what will happen here, and while I don't care that the pollution control tax credit expansion dies, I am concerned about the biodiesel part of it dying as well. So I think it would make more sense for us to amend this to find a compromise that lets the pollution control tax credit die and keep the biodiesel incentives in the air. And that would be my desire to do that.
And thank you, Representative. And it's been my understanding that there has been some discussion of that compromise. Perhaps that's what happens in the Senate. Representative Galizio.
Yeah, not too much to add. I like how you ended on keeping biodiesel in the air. Is that what you wanted? But I feel about this bill the way I feel about the Star Trek series. I really like the original iteration, absent the pollution control tax credit as well. So I was really excited. You know, in the newspaper, The Oregonian, at the beginning of the session, you had the political odd couple and Representative Dingfeld and Representative Krupp and this urban-rural divide. So biofuel is something that I think is really an exciting prospect, but that particular element that Representative Hass just talked about is, I think, problematic. So I'll be opposing it.
Thank you very much, Representative Galizio. And I guess I would say that I harken back to the testimony of one person who testified here that said, hey, anytime you're ready to go to the EPA standards in the state of Oregon, like most of the other states have, let us have at them, and you can take the credits off, and we won't need them. And I that was pretty persuasive to me. If we're going to have these kinds of businesses in the state of Oregon under a DEQ standard, which is so much greater than the EPA's Clean Water and Clean Air Acts, then the only way that we can remain competitive is to offer these kinds of incentives, is my understanding. Representative Olson?
Mr. Chair, I understand what Representative Hass is saying about hijack, because I almost kind of feel that way to some degree with this too. I mean, I'm going to vote yes for this, hoping for the best coming from the Senate, I mean, to get this squared away. If If it doesn't, then I guess I'll have my opportunity again on the floor then when it comes back.
You bet. Is further discussion? Representative Riley.
I just wanted to say, you know, I'd much rather have actual clean air than a Clean Air Act.
We'll put that in the form of a motion. We'll probably have a second for it. We'd get it back. Representative Boquist.
Much like what Representative Olson said, because, you know, both of us have rural portions of the valley, but, you know, the biofuel bill is critical to us, and I will vote yes. And hope we could have a compromise in the bar chamber. But I mean, the single most important focus here is the biofuel section. So, thank you.
I think we all agree that that's very important. And some kind of reconciliation needs to be made with regard to those folks who are stranded in Oregon with their businesses that will be losing pollution control credit if it moves through the Senate in that fashion. So I'm anxious about that. The motion then is to move House Bill 3481 as amended by the A6 to the House floor with the due pass recommendation. Those in favor will say aye at the roll call.
Representative Oakley.
Yes.
Representative Vestal.
Aye.
Representative Felicia.
No.
Representative Kong.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair House.
House votes no, sir. It's notice of possible minority report.
And Chair Butler.
Butler votes aye. House Bill 3481, having received the required votes to pass it to the floor, the motion is passed. That will go to the floor of the due pass recommendation with the A6 amendment. And Representatives Anderson, Krupp, and I'm not sure where Representative Dingfelder is at, will be the carriers on that amongst the, however they want to order themselves. These are the folks that have been lobbying to get this done. So with that, that House bill moves forward to the floor of the due pass motion, and recognize that Representative Hass serves notice of possible minority report. With that, colleagues, we will close the work session on House Bill 3481.
31, we have amendments.
I don't know that we're back.
And I don't know that
they're right. Okay, all right. Colleagues, we're posted for Thursday on those items which we haven't finished up today. We'll come back and work on Thursday, and we have some other that will be posted on the calendar at that time as well. If there's no other business for today, we will close House Revenue Committee for the day. Okay.